characterizing drugs. Psychedelic drugs, hallucinogenic drugs, entheogens, visionary plants. The modern era involves much use of psychoactive drugs, but not integrated into culture. It's as though drugs are different in different cultures, different cultural milieus, so that psychoactive drugs in a modern context is something different than psychoactive drugs in the ancient context. When people say, it's ridiculous to think that ancients were drug addicts, they're projecting the modern context for drugs, or they're projecting drugs as conceived in the modern context with the modern association network back into the association network of antiquity, which misrepresents the association network in antiquity. Thus, every word really has a different meaning, and everything has a different meaning in the modern culture context and the modern association network compared to the association network and meaning of antiquity. Wine and beer before the modern era essentially mean plant mixture or psychoactive plant mixture in a generic sense. It could mean anything. Well, especially things like henbane, datura, belladonna, mandrake, opium, cannabis, psilocybin mushrooms, amanita mushrooms, and ayahuasca combinations, which, as Benny Shannon points out, were present in the Dead Sea area in antiquity. This is the challenge of talking about antiquity. We are here talking about antiquity in the modern or late modern era using words. But the problem is that translation is an illusion. The ancients had Hymarmony, and we have determinism, but the problem is, we can say that the word determinism is a translation of the word hymarmony, or phaetum. That's the Greek word hymarmony, or the Roman word phaetum, translating supposedly to the English word determinism, or necessity. The problem is, word networks and concept networks, not just word networks, but concept networks that are conveyed through words. These concept networks have a leaky translation, like the term leaky abstraction from computer science. All of our translations of ancient words into modern English are leaky translations, or broken translations, or mistranslations. When we talk about the words belief, the word faith, the word Christianity, the cross, Jesus, Paul, apostle, disciple, testament, all of these words are mistranslations. We should think of them really as mistranslations. It helps us to understand the words when we first understand translation as inherently mistranslation. So that even goes for things like drugs, like psychoactive drugs, or marriage. Marriage, the word and concept, let's brush aside words and talk about concepts. The concept of marriage in English in the modern era is not equivalent to the concept of marriage in antiquity. It's a mistranslation, a conceptual mistranslation. The word drug or pharmacon or psychoactive drug in modern English, in late modern English, is a conceptual mistranslation of the ancient terms like pharmacon. Did Christians have belief? Yes and no. Sort of, but not translated accurately. Did they have faith? Did they have belief? Did they consider Jesus to be Lord? Yes and no. Not exactly. We have drugs. They had drugs? No, not exactly. We have marriage. Did they have marriage? Not exactly. They had something that is very roughly sort of equivalent to our marriage, faith, belief, drugs, Lord, and so on. Against Stephen Katz, drugs have the same psychoactive, psychedelic drugs, visionary plants, have the same effect on everyone in every culture. In a sense, the same effect. The psychedelic plants loosen cognitive associations. Whether you are Asian, modern Asian, modern European, ancient Mediterranean dweller, the hallucinogens have the same effect. If you give a psychedelic to a person, the person will trip out. They will have loose cognitive associations. Against Stephen Katz, they will have loose associations regardless of their cultural context. Yes, culture has some effect on interpretation of the experience and the experience of the experiencing, but there's an aspect of experiencing that is not culturally dependent. That is loose cognitive association. So I'm defining almost a yet another level or aspect or area of cognition that is immune to the criticisms of Stephen Katz. It is a constant across cultures, just as even across human or machine mentality in the song Body Electric by Rush, or the song at the end of the album Moving Pictures about computer chips and memory chips. Bytes break into bits. That is true, just as, say, DNA is, it behaves the same ways across cultures. Well, the same with the level of cognitive science that I have always been a leader in this research, similar to Benny Shannon, in defining a whole conceptual vocabulary about loose cognitive association and mental construct association matrices and mental construct processing. There is an aspect of mental construct processing that changes in the altered state when the psychedelic is administered that's the same for people independently of cultural constructions. Yes, aspects of experiencing depend on cultural constructions, like to people in different religions, in perhaps different areas and eras. Yes, there are aspects of their tripping out that will be culturally constructed and distinct, like different metaphor systems, and in some respects, different experiencing will result when two people in two different cultures are tripping out and are given acid. You go back and give acid to Asians and Mediterranean people in antiquity or in the modern era, all of them will experience in different ways that are affected by their cultural constructions, but in other aspects, they will all experience the same things, or cognition will change in certain specific ways that are invariant across these cultures. Specifically, when you administer acid to these people in these different cultures, they will all experience the same aspect of loosening of cognitive associations, regardless of their cultural constructions. Our DNA is not essentially different than that of the ancients, despite freaking Gandhi's joke in their book, The Jesus Mysteries, that the ancients must have had a different constitution because my, oh my, how wine affected those ancients so differently than us that they had intense religious experiences because of watered down wine, which freaking Gandhi say tongue in cheek. They know full well that a few thousand years ago, the ancients didn't have a different physiology. Now, Jonanna Groenwald tries to wave her arms vigorously, along with John Pilch, to explain that somehow, because ancients had a different culture, that made them trip out intensely through merely going through the motions of a shared meal, a regular meal, that somehow the ancient culture was such a different cultural context that as a result they tripped out and had intense religious experiences through merely having a shared regular meal together. To which I say, of course, BS, complete BS. The ancients did not have that different of a cultural construction around them or a different physiology like freaking Andy joked. Stephen Katz can highlight all he wants the cultural constructions that differ across cultures, but the fact remains, when you administer acid to people, it inevitably causes a particular, as a constant, it always causes the same particular change. Their mind experiences loosening of mental associations, regardless of their cultural constructions. Now, the ancient Mediterranean, I mean the culture around the Mediterranean and Persia since, say, 800 BC to, say, 500 CE, they used in a culturally integrated way, fully culturally integrated way, they used psychedelic drugs and visionary plants, including opium and henbane, for example. They used those to cause their effects of loosening mental associations. Now, they did have a different cultural construction built up on those. So we can say we moderns often use psychoactive drugs all the time. It's tabooed and not culturally integrated, but we do in fact use drugs a lot. And in Italy, they recently found a way to determine, to measure the actual amount of drug use, and it's much higher than the reported rate. People, of course, are not reporting their rates of how often they do use drugs, but it's a lot higher than the official story would admit. Modernity very heavily uses, especially in the late modern era, very heavily uses psychoactive plants and drugs and chemicals. Did the ancients in the ancient Mediterranean use drugs? Yes and no. In a narrow technical specific sense, yes, they used drugs, they used visionary plants, which caused in them, like anyone in any era, loosening of cognitive associations. Did they use drugs? Were they drug addicts in some sort of late modern sense? No, they built up different cultural constructions than are built up in the modern era around the use of drugs. These distinctions, these different cultural constructions built up around certain cultural elements or objects like drugs make it very difficult for us to talk at all about the plausibility and make it very difficult to evaluate the plausibility, whether it was plausible or not, that the ancients used drugs in their religion as a normal practice. Michael Rinella complains all the time in his thesis about Greek use of visionary mixtures that so often the error of presentism is committed. I think Jonanda Groenwald's thesis also complains about the error of presentism, where we try to ask questions about the ancients, but we misask them in a distorting way, where we ask the questions, but we import covertly a whole huge raft of associations and mental associations that we should not be importing. We should be asking clean questions and realizing that each word in our question and our conceptual framework, each word has only a mistranslation into the old mental association network. That is some discussion of the topic psychomimetic drugs, that is, psychotomimetic drugs or hallucinogenic drugs. Other topics include references to LSD, psychedelia, and Tim Leary found in emerging church podcasts and weblogs. Fairly frequently in reading book reviews, listening to podcasts, reading weblogs in the emergent church movement, it is easy to find mentions of acid and psychedelics and hippies and Tim Leary. The people in the emergent movement are no strangers. They're not oblivious and ignorant. Oblivious to or ignorant of psychedelics. We have every reason to assume that some percentage of Christian rock groups use psychedelics in a way that's integrated into their Christianity, into their Christian spirituality. Like the subject of ahistoricity, the subject of psychedelics is marginalized, very literally marginalized, and shoved out of the main text and into the margin in writings by Christians or scholars of Christianity. Often, it's not uncommon to find psychoactive drugs and ahistoricity mentioned between the covers of Christian books about Christian origins. But where is it mentioned? It's permitted only to be mentioned as an aside in the foreword or preface or footnote or an endnote. But it's never, these subjects are never, because it's taboo, they're never permitted to be addressed front on within the body of the work. Head on. Only sideswipes and asides are permitted. Incidental mentions slipped in, but never to confront the topic head on. That's very rare. Thus, these authors are aware of psychedelics, just as our culture heavily uses psychoactives, but psychoactives are not integrated into the thinking and writing of these authors. What's needed is to change that and to very prominently and very fully do a complete and thorough rounded engagement with psychoactive drugs within the main body of the books and articles by scholars and authors who write about Christian origins. To what extent are psychoactive drugs used at all by those people who are in the emergent movement? Defining that extent would include subdivisions like defining the extent to which drugs are used in a integrated way, integrated into this emergent Christian practice. To get back to authentic early New Testament Christianity would require foregrounding the use and centrally making the number one focus of New Testament the use of psychedelic drugs, but not as an isolated lone goal in itself. Rather, using psychedelics in a certain way through a certain interpretive framework in terms of the kingdom of God, and for the purpose of setting up a cultural framework along the lines of the kingdom of God, as described in the New Testament, and as described in the complaints and criticisms of the Old Testament prophets. What evidence is there? What arguments are there? What scenarios are there for the thesis that all ancient religion had a drug basis? Keep in mind what I said, that all concepts and objects and conceptual categories in the modern era are mistranslations that only very roughly map to the ancient connotation networks and mental association networks and conceptual networks. the whole question about evidence for drug use, one can say, oh, I'm blind to that. I don't see that at all. There's no convincing evidence at all. But that is maintained by, that apparent lack of evidence is maintained by retaining a modern, by covertly and unconsciously and unacknowledgedly retaining and maintaining a modern era conceptual association network. When we ask whether drugs were the basis of all ancient religion, we must quit this noxious, inexcusable habit of retaining covertly the modern era conceptual framework network. We must ask the question in such a way that does not import the modern taken for granted assumption framework about what drugs are all about. We do need to do data structuring of evidence. We do need to utilize all modern tools, but in a controlled, skillful way, not in a sloppy, assumed way. People who deny evidence for the ancient drug basis of religion invariably have to do so by covertly importing, sloppily and non-masterfully importing, not just modern tools and the power of modern thinking, like modern systematic thinking, but rather they have to do so by sloppily importing arbitrary, unjustified conceptual combinations from the modern era and covertly projecting those onto antiquity as though they have to and as though those are the only options for conceptualizing the use of drugs in antiquity. Evidential data for theories is structured, not unstructured. Early Christianity did not involve a single historical Jesus and did involve visionary plants, as did the entire Roman Empire. People ask for so-called evidence for this view. Particularly, they ask for evidence that early Christianity involved visionary plants. But what happens is that people hold the predominant paradigmatic interpretive assumption framework in mind. While they purport to look at the evidence, they view the evidence, or what is potentially evidence, through a default unexamined assumption framework, which, of course, is designed to not perceive that evidence as significant evidence. What is required is evidence with interpretation, including, as well, entire alternative scenarios and explanations. So what actually enables a paradigm shift, or a change of explanatory models, amounts to evidence with explanation, with framework, with scenario, not isolated bits of evidential data. All the time I see people pick up the bits of data, but then proceed to consider them within an explanatory framework that is not at all the framework that is required to perceive that data as significant, change-compelling data. This approach also helps for examining data for determining whether Jesus existed or not. The only way the case can be made for ahistoricity of Jesus and Paul is to define an entire scenario and fully unpack what specifically it means for the phrase, that historical person did not exist. And to do that in conjunction with picking up and examining pieces of evidential data as explicitly and particularly structured data, that is, deliberately and consciously structured data, explicitly structured data. Does the evidential data fit better into the currently predominant explanatory model and the received structure of conceptual networks? Or does it fit better into the new model, the new explicit, deliberate, newly specified conceptual combination as a more readily clarifying interpretive lens? Data is not something separate from explanatory system organization or conceptual networks in practice for theory construction and in competition between theories or competition between conceptual networks. All data is theory-bound and bound into conceptual networks, whether those networks are conscious and explicit or unconscious and implicit only. Data is always theory-bound, either by the predominant theory or by a competing alternative challenger theory. The whole challenge for the alternative proponent is to prevent the defenders of the predominant paradigm from pulling the old false move of covertly filtering the data through the old predominant paradigm, through the old received conceptual network, and to force people to actually look at the data through the new defined explanatory paradigm rather than through the old explanatory assumption framework. A classic bogus move is to draw all attention to isolated bits of data, not because you care about those bits of data, but sheerly for the distractive purpose of drawing attention away from the sneaky, covert use of the old paradigm lens. The same holistic data-within-framework view is required for explaining what really happened and didn't happen on 9/11/2001. Challenging the official explanation heavily involves truly alternative why questions, motives, and scenario issues, which are questions of structure of data or conceptual networks, not merely isolated, unstructured bits of evidential data. The best way to protect a false theory and to defend a phony, bunk historical explanation is to only permit examining isolated bits of evidential data while always evaluating those isolated bits of explanatory evidence through the currently predominant official story, lens, or explanatory assumption framework, always as a covert conceptual network that is unjustified and unjustifiable and would collapse if examined in the light of critical comparison of competing alternative conceptual networks. The language of structured data could be useful as against the bad habit of treating data as though it were inherently unstructured, while of course applying a covert, unconscious, or unacknowledged predominant default structuring system to view that data. The reference book to refer to here is by Paul Thagard, Thagard, titled Conceptual Revolutions, 1992. There are specifiable cognitive mechanisms in the process of switching to a new competing explanatory framework, even though Thomas Kuhn's model of paradigm conversion made it seem like paradigm conversion was occult and hidden and irrational. Thagard explains complex networks and hierarchies of concepts, conceptual networks. He explains mental structures and conceptual systems. He explains how conceptual systems develop so that a new conceptual system eventually provides greater explanatory coherence, that's a key phrase, greater explanatory coherence than the previous conceptual system. He covers conceptual hierarchy transformation, that is, the transformation of conceptual hierarchies, and how concepts are recombined, how concepts are added into large-scale conceptual systems, and how concepts are deleted from large-scale conceptual systems. He thus brings Thomas Kuhn's theory of paradigm conversion to completion, resulting in a powerful way of thinking about conceptual revolution in any domain. He explains thus intellectual conversion in general, which applies naturally to what happens in the altered state during religious conversion, or conversion from irreligiosity to religious consciousness, which means awareness of a sense in which oneself is a powerless puppet in relation to that which gives rise to everything, or God. In Christian writings, this change, this conceptual revolution, and paradigm conversion is sometimes referred to as spiritual regeneration of the psyche. The mind is innately designed to harbor two distinct world models: the world model, the mental world model of the ordinary state of consciousness, and the mental world model that results from some exposure to the altered loose association state of consciousness, along the lines of Charles Tart's call for multi-state sciences. We could as well talk about multi-state philosophy, philosophy of mind, and cognitive phenomenology must include, to be at all interesting and relevant and reach its potential at all, philosophy of mind must include multi-state philosophy, which means taking into account not only the ordinary tight-binding cognitive state, where there's tight cognitive binding, but the altered state, which involves loose cognitive association binding. Religious conversion, revelation, or spiritual transformation is a matter of the mind switching from the one innate, predetermined mental world model of self and world to the other innate, predetermined mental world model of self and world. Now, the eventual innate, predetermined mental world model of self and world, which is the religious view, the religious conceptual system, is not synonymous with the altered state. Rather, it's that mental conceptual system and world model which results from exposure repeatedly to the altered state of consciousness, which is the loose cognitive association state. This discussion of the structuring of concepts and the structuring of alternative competing conceptual systems is required as a preliminary to any discussion of the supposed data that enables building up a hypothesis that all ancient religion had a drug basis. It is necessary to establish these paradigmatic factors because otherwise, inevitably, I've seen it endless times, the received view inevitably defends itself every time by waving aside and ignoring these paradigmatic issues and insisting on covertly importing the received view as a conceptual network on top of these potential data for the competing explanatory framework. The only way the competing explanatory framework can win out is by making explicit the covert conceptual networks that prevent from that switch. It's a kind of a defensive move on the part of the received view. It defends itself by rendering covert the received conceptual networks. And so the competing framework has to make those assumptions overt, has to force people against their will, has to force the defenders of the received view to come out and get explicit about their arbitrary conceptual networks. A reference here is Daryl Doty's article, Pauline Paradigms, in the Journal of Higher Criticism. Therefore, I highly recommend, I give highest recommendations to Thagard's book, Conceptual Revolutions, and to Daryl Doty's book, Pauline Paradigms. Other radical critics, like Daryl Doty, also typically, to confirm what I was just asserting, it is typical and normal for radical critics to open up their work and begin it by talking about paradigms and talking about covert, unacknowledged conceptual association networks, thus affirming what I just asserted, that the competing theory has to force the defenders of the received view to switch from unconscious, unacknowledged conceptual networks to shining light in those dark places and rendering explicit what was formerly implicit and taken for granted from the very beginning. They have to force a discussion of what was previously treated as outside the boundary of discussion, those unacknowledged assumptions, which amount to conceptual network systems. I was on the verge of posting a most substantial posting in the Jesus Mysteries group to fulfill a request by someone to lay out the evidence that Christianity was based on drugs. However, the censorious moderators stepped in and forcefully killed the conversation, or did their best to try to kill it, right before I could post that. Which, you could say, well, I'm free to write anyway, but the forum was important, and I was thus demotivated, whereas for a short time I had been motivated by that discussion forum to do a good, clear job of laying out the evidence. Now, it's not really hard. I'm becoming more focused on the minimal, easy path of what it would really take to make the case. It's not actually difficult. We just have to figure out and discover the easy way to make the case. At this late date, we have more than enough chest full of evidence to make the case, and just as importantly, I have created explanatory systems. I'm basically the first to create a full-fledged, adequate explanatory scenario and framework, as well as just the raw sheer bits of data. What the post was designed to be, how it was designed to be shaped, was to list a matching set of evidential data and arguments and scenarios and conceptual networks, because it's never going to be enough to just lay out data. In fact, we've seen that. We have an example proving that it's never enough to lay out data, but that it's also always necessary to lay out an alternative system and structuring of the data. The book Shroom by Andy Letcher, he takes up a small percentage of the bits of evidential data for drug use in ancient religion and dismisses it carelessly based on, by employing and deploying covert, assumed modern-era conceptual networks, he is thus able to simply wave aside whole truckloads of data by simply declaring them irrelevant, like Christian mushroom trees. He sets up straw men, certain interpretations that are supposedly required for the mushroom depictions to be relevant, and then demolishes those arbitrarily chosen straw men systems or interpretive systems. He doesn't, however, take up a fair range of different conceptual systems to structure the data. So, in essence, to abstract a little here, in terms of bits of data and structures of evidential data, he approaches the bits of data and he chooses to consider the data in a couple of structure systems, the modern era received system and maybe one other system of structuring the data, like the system of secret mushroom cults that go back to antiquity, tracing a particular thread of how they're handed down. So, and then the modern conceptual system is that drugs weren't used at all in religious history. He considers those two data structures or potential competing structurings of the evidential data, but that's all. He does not consider anything like the structuring of evidential data that is put forth by the maximal and theogen theory of religion and culture. He does not consider that drug use may have been overt, mainstream, and very heavily present within the Christian mainstream in prior to modernity. The maximal and theogen theory of religion thus amounts to a proposed conceptual network or data structuring, a structuring of the evidential data, which is extremely important. It's useless to try to consider the bits of evidential data in isolation when it's really the structuring of the evidential data that makes all the difference in the world. You have to have, of course, both bits of evidential data and structuring conceptual networks within which to place those bits of evidential data. According to the ego death theory, the structure or data structure is the maximal entheogen theory of religion, and the bits of data for specifically the extent of psychoactive drug use within religious Christian history amounts to hundreds and actually, I believe, thousands of pictures, thousands of depictions of psychoactive mushrooms within Christian art, and patterns of using language, as in talking about the Eucharist in a way that completely fits with it being a psychoactive, affecting religious experiences and shifts in mental world models about self, world, and time. That way of using language does constitute evidence. And the depictions of mushrooms in Christian art are a kind of evidence. And the maximal entheogen theory of religion is a kind of a structuring of evidential data. Also, there's some structure involved in reading the church fathers' writings about the Eucharist and the fact that the Eucharist was centrally important. Now, that is something that's very left out by one of the crimes of interpretation shared by conservative Christianity and the liberal mainline denominations and the emergent movement, Protestants, Catholic, and evangelicals. They all fail to put, well, Catholics may be accepted, but in general, during the modern era, all the versions of Christianity committed the interpretive crime of not putting first priority on the Christian Eucharist. Now, you can see evidence when you study carefully. The careful writers and authors do put the first emphasis on the Eucharist as the first among the sacraments, the second being baptism, and the other Catholic sacraments are all sort of optional and are opted out from by the Protestant tradition. Again, in the Catholic tradition, there are numerous sacraments, including Eucharist and baptism, but in the Protestant tradition, which was seeking to have a minimalist approach, Protestants only accepted two sacraments, baptism and the Eucharist, and of those two, they consider the Eucharist to be the more important one. In that sense, yes, modern Christianity does do the right thing in giving the Eucharist pride of place. However, that is not followed through at all consistently. There ought to be much more emphasis. I was amazed to discover that denominations were different than the denomination I was familiar with, which was Churches of Christ, which have communion every week. I just assumed that all other Christian denominations, of course, took communion once a week. I was amazed to find that some of them almost never take communion. But the communion is how we are saved. We are not saved by just believing and thinking about something about Jesus. We are saved by eating and drinking the blood and flesh of Jesus, which is the Eucharist. Why is that? That's because we're ingesting the psychedelic drug, which thus, when interpreted in a way according to the New Testament, causes a mental regeneration of a kind which drives us toward the kingdom of God. It's important when putting forth an alternative paradigm to not only spread the net as far and wide as possible and gathering all possible evidence. That can actually work against you and make it look like it's difficult to justify the alternative framework. But keep more like a minimalist modern era system, which is efficient and compact and elegantly compact. No more evidence is needed than this little bit. The argument is so clear-cut that when you look at the thousands of mushrooms and visionary plants in Christian art and look at the patterns of the way that the language of the Eucharist was used and the fact that the Eucharist was the center of Christian practice, according to the Church Fathers, they talk about the Eucharist in precisely the way that a well-informed and experienced person would talk about the religious effects of psychedelics, informed by heavy use of metaphorical description as well. And I would also perhaps include a theory of Greek myth and how the psychedelics phenomenology are reflected in Greek myth. That right there is the evidence. It's the evidence and the data structure, or the explanatory framework, together with the evidential bits of data, right there is sufficient to prove that the Christian religion originally and normally used psychoactive drugs, and that also another aspect that we have to bring in, for all practical purposes, we practically have to bring in the fact of all ancient religion having primarily a psychedelic drug basis as well. Well, I may say psychoactive visionary plant basis, to include opium and henbane, for example. Now, this demolishes a major error of Allegro, because he tried to portray Christians as being distinctive and unusual and abnormal in their use of psychedelic drugs within the context of the Roman Empire. It is easy to summarize what's right and wrong with Allegro. He was right that there was no historical Jesus or Paul or apostles. He was right that psychedelic drugs were involved in the origins of Christianity. He was wrong in treating Amanita as though it were a special drug that they used, to the exclusion of others' drugs. And he is wrong, most grandly wrong, in assuming that the Roman Empire religion and culture did not use psychoactive drugs. Similarly, once the preliminary issues are gotten out of the way, it is easy to summarize a compact proof that Christianity was based on a psychedelic Eucharist. All you have to do is point out the thousands of depictions of visionary plants in Christian art, even if it was later Christian art, and point out the way that the Eucharist was always described as a transformative psychedelic, in the same way one would describe a transformative psychedelic that produced religious revelation, and then point out how the same arguments can be made for Greek myth and the Roman Empire culture in terms of the sacrificial altar, the pouring a libation on the altar, and the incense, and then use the fact of superior explanatory coherence that results from this hypothesis. This hypothesis of this interpretation of depictions of visionary plants in art, and this hypothesis of this reading of discussions of the Eucharist, the fact that this view provides greater explanatory coherence is itself a kind of evidence that's intertwined with structuring of evidence, structuring of arguments, structuring of explanatory systems and conceptual networks. The explanation works, and thus is superior to the competing explanation, which is really no explanation at all. What is the competing received view about that would be relevant to drugs in religious origins? Well, the competing view would have to be some sort of compelling, rational, explicit explanation of how the ancients had religious experience and why they discussed the Eucharist in the way that they did.